You're listening to BBC Radio 3. It's now a quarter past midday. Laurie Blake travels back to the Paris of 1912, a year which was a fruitful one for the composer Claude Debussy.
The summer of 1912 was hot, and there was no time for the annual holiday by the sea for the family of Claude Debussy. Debussy's daughter, Chouchou, aged 7, was very disappointed, and Debussy said she had composed a rather ungracious song in English, saying the sea is annoyed not to have had a visit from Monsieur et Madame Debussy or their charming daughter. Musicologist Robert Orlidge knows why Chouchou's hopes were dashed.
Debussy needed to see the sea as much as Chouchou did every year to keep himself sane. Partly it was expense, partly it was the great amount of work. And all he finished up with was a weekend at Durand's country home, that's his publisher, in August. And that was the lot for that year. At the same time, there was an intense heat while he was writing Jeu. He complained of 32 degrees centigrade in the shade at the end of July. And this and the noise from the railway tracks just by his home didn't make composition any easier.
But it was productive. Debussy was working on the second book of preludes for piano, orchestrating the orchestral image Gigue, and thinking of a clutch of pieces that were on his desk. His main compositional efforts, though, were devoted to his last orchestral work, the ballet Jeu, or Games, commissioned by Diaghilev for the Ballet Russe. Debussy's first reaction to it was dismissive. He sent Diaghilev a telegram which said, "Subject matter idiotic, not interested." But he changed his tune.
At the back of it all is his need for money. And Debussy has a huge debt. By April 1912, he's in debt by 42,866 francs to his publisher. And that's a lot of money in those days. And he managed to pay off about 10,000 francs of his debt by the next year as a result of doing that.
Debussy did manage to change the original plot. To begin with, it seems Diaghilev was keen on three young men engaging in flirtatious pursuits on, and by implication, off the tennis court. Both Debussy and Nijinsky, who was going to choreograph and dance in the ballet, objected to this. Debussy also took exception to the wild idea of an aeroplane crash.
There originally was going to be an aeroplane crash at the end, but there's a nice letter from Diaghilev to Debussy, which shows that Debussy actually objected to it, and him telling Debussy that it was only going to be a sort of airship actually painted on the back scenery. But if he didn't really like that, that could go as well. I mean, can you imagine an aeroplane crashing in Debussy's music?
So a compromise was reached. The setting is a garden at dusk. A tennis ball rolls across the stage. A man arrives looking for it, followed by two young women. Flirtations occur between the man and the women, and when the man hesitates, between the two women. The man decides to pursue them both, but a second tennis ball is thrown into the garden. The games are interrupted, and the three run off stage. Debussy softly sets the opening scene, leading up to the arrival of the tennis ball.
Thank you.
Pierre Boulez conducting the Cleveland Orchestra. It may have been the pressure of Nijinsky wanting to start work as soon as possible, but Debussy completed the piano score, which lasts 16 minutes, in just 3 weeks on August the 23rd. Pianist and writer on music Roy Howard thinks that had a bearing on the final composition.
I think he was capable of composing quite quickly, but then he would put things aside if he had the time to do this, and he would chew on them and mull on them and just make sure they were really the way he wanted them. With Jeu, he didn't have the chance to do that. He had to deliver. I think maybe the fact that Debussy had to write Jeu in a hurry meant that he pushed his risks very far and then had to let them go, leave them there. I wonder if he had had 3 years to write the piece, he might have done that, looked at it and let it sit for a while and then revised it and made it a little bit safer. So Debussy does push his risks right to the extreme, but they're very carefully calculated.
And how do those risks affect, for instance, the composition of melodies?
He has two ways of writing melodies, I think. One is that he'll tease us. This is his sort of form of musical foreplay. He'll tease us with little arabesques that twiddle around in various voices and take your attention high in the texture and then take your attention here. And there's a whole dialogue. It's more than a dialogue. It's a whole conversation of little arabesques that repeat themselves, pass themselves around the orchestra or around the piano texture. Gradually, you're aware that through that, there are melodies slowly working in the middle of the texture.
You're very much aware of these small fragments, these motifs that gradually change and develop.
This is the pianist Alistair Beetson, who has performed the version for piano and has got to know the score intimately.
In the very short scale, things are incredibly fascinating. Just to look at a series of four bars or eight bars, and there's so much minute interest and excitement and shape. But the other element is this wonderful large-scale sense of a satisfying proportion and of a very long trajectory and a serious sense of purpose that seems to be carried despite the fragmented nature of it. Ballet is set amongst the shadows of trees and bushes and a rather enchanted twilight, and this sort of sensitized atmosphere is very appropriate to conjuring up the sounds and the mystery and excitement of the music.
Alistair Beetson revelling in the textures of what could be considered Debussy's longest sustained piece for piano. Roy Howard also identifies the sense of proportion mentioned by Alistair Beetson.
The big build-up to the main climax in Jeu, I think you have 111 bars followed by 111 bars, but each of these blocks contains entirely different music. He seemed to like these numbers. Numbers are important in Debussy structures. What tends to happen is after you've had these voices slowly coursing along, not doing anything that's eminently whistleable, for example, after a while they'll work themselves up into a real singable melody, and he'll time that very carefully. He'll put that, as he always does, exactly where he wants to in the structure, suddenly to catch our attention. But once you hear them, they sound vaguely familiar. In fact, we've been getting them in small fragments all the way through the piece. It's little bits of jigsaws he's giving us. They're put back in a different order, and now you think, ah, now this is the way they really belong together.
At last the teasing is over, and the melody takes centre stage. Debussy was at his most elusive in Jeu, this subtle masterpiece for orchestra. But at the beginning of the summer, he had a foretaste of a piece that was to thump the orchestra into the modern age. 2 years earlier, in 1910, Debussy had complimented Stravinsky on stage after the first performance of his ballet Firebird, and they'd become friends. He'd then been hugely impressed by Petrushka, and Stravinsky was now keen to try out his latest ballet score on the elder composer, The Rite of Spring, in a version for piano duet. Imagine the atmosphere when these two musical giants sat at the piano together to play through the new work. The pianist Peter Hill is very much aware of this significant moment in musical history.
This took place on the 9th of June 1912, and there's an account of it by Louis Lalois, in whose house the performance took place. He says, "One bright afternoon in the spring of 1912, I was walking about in my garden with Debussy. We were expecting Stravinsky. As soon as he saw us, the Russian musician ran with his arms outstretched to embrace the French master, who over his shoulder gave me an amused look. Stravinsky had brought an arrangement for four hands of his work, The Rite of Spring. Debussy agreed to play the bass part. Stravinsky asked if he could remove his collar. His sight was not improved by his glasses, and pointing his nose to the keyboard and sometimes humming a part that had been omitted from the arrangement, he led into a welter of sound the supple, agile hands of his friend. Debussy followed without a hitch and seemed to make light of the difficulty. When they'd finished, there was no question of embracing nor even of compliments. We were dumbfounded, overwhelmed by this hurricane which had come from the depths of the ages and which had taken life by the roots." It's barely credible that even a musician of Debussy's capabilities could actually have sight-read a piano duet version of The Rite of Spring. It's an immensely complicated work. It took orchestras decades to learn how to play it properly, as we know from old recordings, and the piano duet version is every bit as difficult.
Peter Hill performs and has recorded the piano duet version with Benjamin Frith. In that form, it's a work he thinks gives an insight into the direction Stravinsky is going.
In a way, he strips out all the inessentials, and what you've just got are these great dissonant harmonies, the repetitious folk melodies that characterise the rite, and above all, those rhythms, which
the
are given
power, yes.
Yeah, they're given a kind of extra sharpness, if you like, by the fact that it's just four hands on one piano. There's nothing extraneous. There's nothing to, as it were, blur the sound. So it's very, very hard-edged.
Is that what you find most compelling about performing it?
One is completely gripped, I think, by this marvellous music, which exerts a kind of hypnotic spell, or should do, certainly does, on the performers. One completely loses oneself, I think, in this music. He was one of these composers who always worked at the piano, and one must assume, therefore, that Stravinsky did it on his upright piano, pounding away over and over again to get the rhythms hammered into shape. Stravinsky's arrangement is really a masterpiece. It's one of his really great works for piano, I think, and it's marvellous to play this as a concert piece because remarkably little is left out.
We know you find it compelling, but there must be some difficulties. There are a lot of interweaving.
Yes, indeed. There are passages which are very difficult to bring off because they're arranged, very cleverly arranged, but arranged in a most unorthodox way. For example, I myself tend to play the top part, the upper part in the four-hand version. But when you come to the last dance in part one, the Dance of the Earth, Stravinsky arranges it so that I have to play an ostinato with my left hand underneath the two hands of the second pianist, and my right hand is playing very rapid repeated semiquavers, a sort of mixed up with the two hands of the second pianist. So it takes an awful lot of practice to actually sort that out and make it work, but it can be made to work.
It sounds like you're having to do quite a lot of choreography yourselves.
Indeed, it is sort of, it is a kind of ballet in its own right, as the hands weave together. You know, they in a way express the weaving together of the melodic lines and the rhythms.
Thank you.
And then, of course, I think there's the final section, which is marvellous to play, the danse sacrale, the sacrificial dance itself. Here, the rhythms, if you get them right, and I must say it's very easy to get them wrong, the rhythms of the danse sacrale are so sharp, so hard, so clear, so exciting on the piano. And I think also because there's just the two of you, you can take risks and actually play it faster than most orchestras, in fact, dare to do. We know, or there's pretty convincing evidence, that originally Stravinsky intended the sacrificial dance to be played very, very quickly as a really wild and exhausting piece of music, and that over the years it sort of got solidified into a more kind of granitic type of rhythm, if you like, and, you know, even modern performances take it pretty steadily, actually. That's the way we tend to hear it. But on the piano duet version, I think you can take a kind of gamble and really go for it and sprint for the tape, and you can imagine the chosen victim as literally dying of exhaustion.
Peter Hill and Benjamin Frith bringing Stravinsky's duet arrangement of The Rite of Spring to its deathly climax. In fact, this was one bit that Debussy didn't have to sight-read, since in June 1912, Stravinsky was still deciding how to end the ballet. If that encounter was one of the blistering memories for Debussy of that summer, there was another he would do his best to forget. This was his running battle with the Canadian dancer Maud Allan, for whom he had composed his Egyptian ballet Kammer and finished the piano score earlier that year. Throughout the summer, as Robert Orlidge told me, she was to haunt him.
Maud Allan kept saying that she'd had this agreement with Debussy in which she'd made everything absolutely clear to him, but A, it must have been in English because she didn't speak French, and Debussy only spoke a very small modicum of English. And I suspect that he wanted to get his hands on the 10,000 francs that Maud Allan was offering, would have actually agreed to anything.
A correspondence erupted between the two, which got ever hotter.
Here's Maud Allan's first attack on Debussy, May 1912. I, of course, not fully master the music, but I fear it's going to be far too short. We arranged when I made the contract that the music should be sufficient for a scenario lasting 40 minutes. This, however, would appear to be less than half the duration. I presume, however, that you will lengthen it for me. I should be glad to get your confirmation.
And she suggested that if Debussy wasn't willing, then she was sure one of her own arrangers would be only too happy to take it on. This was not a suggestion that pleased Debussy. In fact, he was furious.
Debussy's reply, written on the 16th of July 1912, says, "I can only reiterate what I said in my previous letter about the music of Kammer. It's impossible that you be permitted to arrange this music to suit your own taste. Thus I composed it, thus it shall remain." So here's Maud Allan replying to Debussy on September the 9th of 1912. Rather sadly and desperately, I think. I am still without a reply from you to my early letter in August. Believe me, Camus needs alterations, and I ask you again to realise this now and not cause further delay and possible trouble, but agree to get at it at once. And finally, in desperation, then Debussy writes to his publisher, Jacques Durand. I must say a few words about this appalling young woman's behaviour. It's intolerable that she should start issuing opinions with no backing whatsoever and expressing them in a language hardly suitable for a bootmaker who's got his instructions wrong. It's enough to make you weep, or better still, to give her a spanking. Even if one's lesson doesn't go to that extreme, it might still be possible to give her a lesson in good manners.
As might be expected, Camus never became part of Maud Allan's repertoire, nor did Debussy ever hear the piece performed in his lifetime. But he did oversee the orchestration, which he delegated to his friend, composer Charles Koechlin. Robert Orlidge considers Debussy's faith in the music completely justified.
In reality, it's one of Debussy's finest scores, and quite different from Je. Je has 21 motifs which change themselves and goes through in quite a sort of sectional manner, fitting the choreography. Camus, on the other hand, has four main themes which are transformed as the drama progresses, very skillfully, in fact. It's really much more of a symphonic and through composed score than Je is.
And the story? It's set in ancient Egypt, where the temple of the sun god Amun-Ra and the surrounding city is being besieged by wild hordes. The dancer, Camus, prostrates herself before the god and performs three dances to persuade him to deliver them from the invaders. When the hands of the god respond to her plea, she gives a final dance of joy, and at the climax of the dance, she dies. Camus' Dance of Death, in the performance by the Concertgebouw Orchestra, conducted by Ricardo Chailly. Despite Maud Allan's irritation and his work on Je, there was a host of other ideas in Debussy's head in 1912. Many of them, like the fall of the House of Usher, destined to remain unfinished. But, between everything else, he continued composing pieces for his second book of Preludes. Thank you. Gruyère, the fifth of the second book of Preludes. Begun in 1911, they occupied Debussy for over a year, and he fitted them in between everything else. They see Debussy becoming ever more adventurous, writing the music often across three staves instead of the usual two, and reflecting some of the influences that he had experienced, from the gamelan to echoes of Stravinsky's Petrushka. Roy Howard is our musical detective.
In the case of the Preludes, he was working on the second book of Preludes from December 1911 onwards. This was a few months after Petrushka, and you can hear echoes of Petrushka in these very strongly. Here's Petrushka. There's from the end of it. Here's how Debussy's second book of Preludes starts. Well, as long as I don't play the right hand, if I play the left hand only, and it ends with the same figuration. It's disguised because he then puts the right hand masking over it. So you have the mouth organ effect from Petrushka starting it. Halfway through the book, you have a little trumpet fanfare starting the clown ragtime piece, General Lavine Excentrique. Now, that fanfare could be followed by two things. It could be followed by what happens in Debussy's Prelude, which is this. Or it could be followed by this. Which is the trumpet solo from Petrushka. It's in the same key. You hear all these echoes.
But Debussy was composing the second book of Preludes throughout 1912 and into 1913. And I wondered whether playing the duet version of The Rite of Spring also left an echo in the music.
I think what's striking here is that he didn't immediately echo it. It was several months later. It's October or November, I think, where he's writing to Stravinsky saying, "The memory of that occasion is still haunting me like a strange sort of irresistible nightmare," or words to that effect. He had already just written Feu d'Artifice, which is the 12th of the Preludes, so it was the 11th, Litières Alternées. It's the one prelude that doesn't have a picturesque title. It's alternating thirds, and it's just what you do at the piano. The two hands play in constant alternation, playing intervals of a third nearly the whole time. And it's in that piece that you suddenly hear a phrase from The Rite of Spring being quoted, again in slight disguise. This had been sort of scratching the back of my mind. Every time I came to this passage, I thought, it is something. I recognise this. What is it? I suddenly realised where it was. So here is how it comes in the ritual action of the ancestors. And then it thunders out a page later. Where you hear it, it's worked into the texture of Debussy's Prelude like this. If I just isolate that. And here's Stravinsky's tune. It's unmistakable once you know it.
And here's the opening of Les Tierces Alternées, played by Roy Howard.
Thank you.
There's something more open-ended about the second book of Preludes. Deliberately, but very skillfully sketchy sometimes, he goes so far and then he'll leave something slightly open. The music's quite porous. It's orchestrally coloured at the piano, and it's quite suggestive of where it could go, but doesn't always bother to go. It's quite elliptical. It takes huge risks, just like Jeu does. And he explores these same harmonic clashes of the octatonic scale. In the seventh of the preludes, La Terrasse des Audiences du Clair de Lune, the Terrace for Moonlight Audiences, there's a particular passage which is very similar to the final build-up in Jeu. It's a slow waltz. Jeu is a fast waltz, so this is like a bit of Jeu in slow motion. And then suddenly he lets all that chromatic tension out at the end. And whenever I hear the final build-up in Jeu, I recognise that passage. It's just happening a lot faster and slightly varied. But all these semitone clashes across the octaves and false relations, it's very spicy. I find my mouth tends to water.
The luxurious moment in Jeu that makes Roy Howitt's mouth water. What Debussy didn't know when Stravinsky visited him that summer with The Rite of Spring tucked under his arm was that the premiere of Jeu on May the 15th, 1913, would be followed 2 weeks later by the premiere of The Rite of Spring, resulting in that greatest of musical scandals in the 20th century. Jeu was eclipsed by the mighty impact of Stravinsky's shattering work. The young pretender overtook the elder statesman, and Jeu was shunted into obscurity. But its influence began to grow in the 1950s and reached into the musical avant-garde.
The piece wasn't well known, and for a long time it was not regarded as one of Debussy's successes. Before people started catching up with him and saw that he really was trying to do something different, and if we followed it and got used to it, there was another world there. Messiaen taught works like this, and I think he made all his students from the very start aware of works like Jeu. And so the Boulez generation got into it. What fascinated them was that the way its structure could mostly be described in terms of what it no longer was rather than what it might be, that what it had broken away from, what it looked back to but was leaving behind. They took that in their own direction in an entirely different sound world. But also the apparently fragmentary nature of it appealed to them. They were deliberately trying to do things that would not connect up big long lines in the old symphonic tradition.
Jeu is the major legacy of that hot summer of 1912 in Debussy's life. Despite complaining of the noise and smell of Brazilians and Americans in the Bois de Boulogne, the frustrations of Maud Allan and the lack of a holiday, Debussy surpassed himself with Jeu. A prophetic and original masterpiece, a work whose primary element was colour and rhythmic modulation. And one of its greatest champions in recent years has been the composer and conductor Pierre Boulez. His deep knowledge of the piece and meticulous performance welds the fragments together and casts the spell that Debussy intended.
You know, if you want to analyse the form, you can describe only, yes, that follows that, follows that, follows that. But you can never say, well, that's a repeat of this form, that's a development of this theme. No, you cannot. There are some themes which are barely recognizable because of the speed, especially. And then, you know, it comes much later in a kind of different speed, on a different angle, with different color, And then I said, yes, maybe I have heard that, but I am not quite sure. It's fluid, it's continuous. And then you say, yes, certainly, I have heard that, but where and when? And it's the mystery of this score that you recognize and you don't recognize in the same time.
Pierre Boulez conducting the final pages of Debussy's Je. Debussy's Summer of 1912 was presented by Lowry Blake and produced by Richard Bannerman. It was a Ladbroke Radio production for BBC Radio 3.